Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 37 of the Theatrical Mustang podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This episode is actually an interview with me, conducted by my friend Michael Morgan. He thought it would be fun for me to be interviewed on my own podcast for my birthday. So that's what this episode is, and it's a conversation about theater and acting and directing and community, all of that. And so I hope you enjoy episode 37, and you'll hear this during the course of the interview, but we're going to have a contest for a theme song. And so if you're a composing type, you can email theatricalmustang@gmail.com with an MP3 of what you think the theme song should be. And if I pick it, then I will take you to lunch or dinner in the Seattle area. So that's kind of fun. Contests are always great. So the birthday podcast, please enjoy.
Ooh, it's very exciting. I have just pushed the record button on Katie Woodzik's fabulous laptop. I am Michael Morgan, and I am honored and excited to be guest hosting this very special birthday edition of the Theatrical Mustang podcast. I had a little idea a while ago, and I said to my dear friend Katie Woodzik, why don't you get interviewed on your fabulous podcast? And she recognized the brilliance of that idea. And of course, made me the honorary interviewer. So here we are. It's almost Katie's birthday, and we're going to celebrate by learning some more about our fabulous host for all you faithful listeners.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on my own podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it was hard to get a hold of your agent, but we made it work.
I'm glad we can make it work out. Can we pretend that it's like a New Yorker, you know how the interviewer is like, you know, I don't know, Amy Poehler arrives and she's wearing chic jeans and she looks like her hair's just been blown back at the beach. Could you, like, do a description like that of me, like, right now? Oh,
absolutely. You're clearly wearing some heretofore seen mix of Gucci and Prada. You arrived in the longest car I've ever seen. I don't understand how it gets around corners. And you, Taye Diggs was your driver.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris Pratt was your personal bodyguard.
Of course.
And Tina Fey is walking right behind you, just feeding you one-liners if you ever need one. So, not that you would.
And now they're all in the car, keeping it cool with the air conditioning. Yeah, thank you.
So, let's get down to it, Katie Woodzik.
All right, let's do it.
I don't know if you've gone over this. This is just a question I have. I haven't listened to every single one of your podcasts.
It's okay.
I'm sorry.
It's
on my list. Are you the theatrical Mustang?
Okay, so that's a really good question, Michael Morgan. So the theatrical Mustang title, actually, I think I've maybe gone over the story, but I'm not sure if I've done it on the podcast yet. But Barton Cole, who's a local actor and a poet, the first year I was here on Whidbey Island, he was talking to our good friend Gina Simpson about me. We were doing a show at Wicca together called The Good Doctor, and he just said, that Katie Woodzik, she's a theatrical Mustang of sorts. And I'm like, that's an amazing compliment.
Yeah.
And so I've just sort of carried that with me, and so when I started a podcast, I'm like, that's like an interesting and provocative name, and for me, it's anyone who has an idea and then has the just the vision and the energy to make that idea happen instead of just talking about it, putting that idea into action. And so that's the kind of people I try to have on the podcast. And it doesn't have to be theater related, because I'm a theater geek hardcore. A lot of the people that I have on the podcast are theater artists, but we've also had composers and choreographers and writers as well.
Awesome. And I think it's a great title because it's so evocative and it's perfect for you. I agree.
Thank you.
And so let's talk about some of those things, because the fun thing about you is that you're all those things you just described. You're quite the Renaissance woman.
Oh, thank you.
A note to our listeners, I am not being paid any amount of money to compliment Katie in this, but I am going to say nice things about her periodically. And then I'll sucker punch her with, like, a hard question. So, yeah, you write, you act, you direct, You design, you social media eyes, you sing, you make things happen. Do we swear on this podcast?
Yes, we can absolutely swear.
You make
swear.
Shit happen. She does. She's a shit happen maker.
Mm-hmm.
I met you in 2009, which was basically exactly 6 years ago.
That's true.
During the callbacks for Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes.
And I should note to our listeners that we are tucked into a very strange, secret little annex in Whidbey Island Center for the Arts.
Thank you, Whidbey Island Center for the Arts, for letting us have this space.
Thank you, yes. We are near a shelf full of toilet paper and a safety light and some canopies in a little closet, basically.
There's some pillars, too, and a bench.
Pillars, yes. There's some Greek flavor in the corner. And it's very theatrical in here because this is what theater is. You find what you can, and you do what you want to with it. But just like 20 feet over and down is where we first met, on the stage, doing crazy semi-sexual dance moves for Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yes.
And what were you doing then? What were you doing in 2009?
What was I doing in 2009? I'm trying to think now. So 2007 to 2008 was AmeriCorps. 2008 to 2009 was AmeriCorps. And so I think at that time I was at Kitchley's Bagel Bakery,
mm-hmm.
slinging bagels and making coffee. And what else is, did you have a specific answer you wanted me to say?
What struck me when I was thinking of all the things you do now is that you weren't doing them then. I didn't think. I was just amazed. Like, I feel like you've blossomed.
Thank you, Michael Morgan.
That's all I have to say.
I do too.
I feel like you're taking things by the reins, and I like it. And it's fun being a part of that.
Feels good.
Yeah. We're not allowed to say what yet, but word on the street is that Katie Woodzik may have been offered a part in a show already for this season. It's not out yet, but you will see her.
I feel like so Hollywood right now. Like,
yeah.
I have a project that I'm really excited about, but I can't talk about it yet. Maybe by the time the podcast goes up, I can say what it is, but I can confirm that you will see me and at least one show on the Whidbey Island Center for the Arts stage this season.
It's going to be awesome. So anyway, I just wanted to give you a birthday props on seizing life by the horns and getting that shit done.
Thank you. That was a pause.
That was a pause. I was just thinking to myself, like, how long can I pause to make it easy for her to edit out the pause? But she'll probably just leave it now because we're talking about it.
I probably will.
Yeah, I like a good
this
pause.
That might be a good segue into how the mechanics of the podcast works.
I was going to get to that, yeah.
But I'm just going to jump in and take the reins of this interview.
No. Tell me about the podcast. What gave you this idea? What made you actually go through with it and make it into this thing that it is today?
Sure. So I had an assignment for Whidbey Life magazine to interview Andrew Grenier to help promote other desert cities. And I love Andy. I have taken a class with him. I have not been cast by him yet, Andy, if you're listening, but that will happen one day. You will be my director one day. Love Andy. I know that he says a lot of good things and quickly, and I didn't think I could keep up taking notes with him. And so I put my iPhone between us at the Bayview Flower Farm Cafe and hit record. And as I was listening back to the to the recording to write, take down notes for the piece that I was writing, it's like, this is almost a podcast. And at that time, I was listening a lot to both Mark Maron and Chris Hardwick's podcasts because I'm a big, big comedy geek, and I love all those interviews, all those interviews with actors and writers and directors. And so I just had a light bulb moment, and I was like, what would I need to do? Because I had already produced my own web series, and it was very low tech. But I did it. I taught myself iMovie, posted things to YouTube. People thought it was funny and whatnot. And so I was like, I bet it's easier than doing a web series.
You don't need lighting.
Right. Not that I ever paid attention to lighting. But And so I did a little bit of research, and shortly thereafter, I reached out to a few different people, and that's sort of a scary thing to be like, I'm starting a podcast. I can't send you anything to listen to. You're just going to have to trust me that it's going to be okay. And I found, I use a site called Podbean, which for $10 a month lets me post as many MP3 files as I want to. And it's cool because it has an RSS feed that talks to both iTunes and Stitcher Radio and a couple other podcast apps. So it just appears on iTunes 24 hours after I post an episode, nice. Which is cool. And so Sheila Weidendorf was the first person to say yes. And so I didn't have the microphone then, so it was just my Mac, and we were sitting cross-legged on her bed, and I was really nervous, and we did it. And then I just sort of got some momentum after that, and I think after the first month or so, I got this microphone, which is a Blue Yeti condenser microphone that plugs into the computer with just a USB cord, and people seem to like it. And then it's cool because now I get requests from press people in Seattle to, I know, to, you know, help promote their shows. I think that's something that we don't really have in this neck of the woods is a long form interview to talk with, long form interview format to go deeper with local artists. Because this neck of the woods, I mean, Seattle and Whidbey Island is just so densely populated with really talented artists who are doing inventive things and making really great work. And they deserve to have that forum to go deeper and not just write a blog post or snap an Instagram photo. So that is the origin story of the podcast.
And it's really, I think, an important public service on a lot of levels. I mean, it's interesting and it's funny and it's cool, but it's also just important to have people have that avenue, because I can't tell you how much more enjoyable it is for me to go see a play or a concert or any kind of artistic or endeavor when I know what's gone into it and I know the backstory of the person involved, and I know what got them there, and like, wow, look at what they've done, instead of just opening the back of a newspaper and be like, oh, what play should I go to?
Right.
It's just that sense of connection that you can get from hearing someone's words. And so I think that's really awesome.
And it's great because now I go to shows in Seattle and people are like, hey, you're that theatrical. Or I was at a callback this week. She's like, you're the woman with the unicorn podcast. No, not the unicorn, the horse. And just things like that being recognized. I used to say that I was Whidbey Island famous, and I still am Whidbey Island famous.
You are.
But now
you're known.
Like people were saying in the ACT box office, they're like, oh yeah, Katie Wozniak, she's doing cool stuff.
Oh, and nice.
So it's like, it's catching on a little bit, which is cool.
Well, that's how it all starts. I mean, everybody starts with a small thing that five people like, and then it gets big, and soon I'll be famous just for knowing you.
That's right.
Yeah. How do you, so you edit it just with the software that's in here?
Oh, right.
And
editing,
it's pretty easy? Or?
Yeah, I do it in GarageBand. I know other people use Audible or, no, that's a book. Audacity. Other people use Audacity. I'm a big fan of Mac products because I like things that are sort of idiot-proof. And for me, it's sort of like the same. I used to like to do collages a lot when I was a little kid, and it's very similar, like the thing of going in and cutting out the parts that you don't want. I edit in GarageBand. Right before I post an episode, I record a little bit of a bumper, and then I put in, there's pre-recorded tracks that are in GarageBand, and so there's an electronic track called Catwalk Short, which is the music that you hear. Maybe someday we'll get to the point of being like Nerdist and having a theme song. That would be really cool.
Yeah. I can't remember what.
Yeah, so if anyone's listening and wants to write the Theatrical Mustang theme song, let me know, because that would be epic.
That would be awesome. And I can't remember what show or thing it is that I've heard where they have a theme and then people will play versions of it and send them in.
They'll play
their own. So you get like one that's on like a bassoon and one that's like synth keyboard. Because people like it. And that's like, you can have like a different.
So composers, send it to me. You can send it to theatricalmustang@gmail.com.
That sounds like a contest.
It is a... Hey, yeah, let's have a contest. If you want to... What should the prize be?
Prize to be announced. Get to meet Katie Woodzik in person.
I will take you out to dinner.
Ooh.
I will take you out to dinner if you send in your theme songs. And the one I select, I will take the composer to dinner in the Whidbey Island or Seattle area.
Sweet.
Bam.
You can't beat that.
Can't beat that.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit.
Okay.
You are an actress.
I am an actress.
That's how I know you most, personally.
That's how most people know me most.
Yes. I will say you are hard to forget on stage.
Thank you.
If you've seen Katie Woodzik on stage, then you know that you've seen Katie Woodzik on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about how that started and what got you into theater and what it's meant to you.
Sure. I was and am an only child. And I was that kid at school who, at the end of each school day, I would go around to all my friends and say, can I come over to your house? Can I come over to your house? And I wouldn't say I was lonely, but I definitely really felt I was really extroverted. I was kind of an awkward kid, but also an extrovert. And so I really fed off the energy of others and really liked hanging out with other kids. I was really, again, awkward and clumsy, and so sports weren't really my thing. But I think the first play I was ever in was a church play, and I was a donkey or something. But we had, similar to Whidbey Children's Theater, we had a program in the area in Madison, Wisconsin, called Playtime Productions. And Teddy Stute ran it, and she wrote original musicals that were fractured fairy tales.
Cool.
And so I started doing those when I was 7, and the first show was Princess and the Pea, and so I was the French princess's lady-in-waiting. But then also I was the dog, because there was a dog in the court, and I just wailed. I like, arr! And I remember very distinctly being 7 and Teddy being like, no, it's not quite right. The howling is not quite right. But I remember having this other moment, because it would tour. So we would do, the home base would be the little theater in the basement of the Monona Public Library. But then we would tour to all the suburbs of Madison. And, you know, we would do stuff on the steps of the state capitol, at the farmer's market. And so it was a thing of having a show that you could take around to a lot of different little towns and whatnot. And I remember we did one, I think it was in Verona, maybe. And there was a little kid who really wanted to meet the dog afterwards. They really liked the dog. And so I remember being with my mom and going up to the kid. And the kid wasn't that much younger than I was, because like I said, I was 7. And I was really hot. And so I took off the dog head. And the kid freaked out. Like, the kid started screaming and crying. And so I think realizing that you could create a character that someone could buy into that much, that
right.
He believed I was a dog.
Right.
And there's also, so I did a lot of those shows, both in elementary school and in middle school. And also there is another summer camp, and I did, what did we do? We did The Hobbit, the musical. Did you know there was a musical version of The Hobbit?
I admit, I have not come across that one.
You might want to, it might be interesting for the children. You guys did The Hobbit, didn't you?
We did The Hobbit, some years back. Melanie Lowy was actually the one that directed that some years ago. I didn't see it was before my time at the children's theater.
But there's a musical version, and I was cast, and I think now we're going forward a little bit, and I'm like 12 years old, I think, 12 or 13, and there's the dragon, Smaug.
Yeah.
And in this version, Smaug has this big jazzy number about breathing fire, and the accompanist, who I can remember her daughter's name. Oh, I remember her name, Bev Pizengurley. She took my mom aside and she said, your daughter has the potential to be a really, really good singer. You should get her in voice lessons. And kudos to my mom, because she did that. You know, she found a really good voice teacher. And so, and then in high school, I did lots of show choir and musicals. And then, you know, went on to major in theater and dance in college. So I think originally the interest in it sprang from, you have that built-in family when you do theater. You have a bunch of other kind of awkward kids who are a little bit too loud or a little bit too gregarious or precocious. And instead of in the classroom a lot, that behavior, and I mean, I was a straight A student and stuff. I did well in school, but that sort of outlandish behavior is not encouraged in a classroom setting often,
right.
But it is encouraged when you're, you know, hardcore theater show choir geek in high school.
Yeah. It, through my own experience as an actor also, and through being a part of Whidbey Children's Theater, it's amazing seeing how theater is a dual thing, because in one respect, it's a haven.
Mm-hmm.
It's a safe place. It's, if you're dealing with adversity at home or bullying or identity issues or any of those things, it's a safe place to come,
mm-hmm.
because everyone there has something they're dealing with. And then the other half, it's a place to be entirely courageous.
Right.
And to put yourself out there and to take risks and to be in the spotlight, literally. And it's an amazing mix of those two things. I know from some of our discussions and from some things that you've shared on social media that you dealt with bullying in some forms growing up and probably into adulthood. And you've also shared things about your gender identity, sexuality spectrum that you are still exploring, as I think any honest person probably still is.
Yeah.
And so maybe you could talk about how that incorporated into the arc of who you are as an artist.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was, so I remember we were doing Sleeping Beauty with Playtime Productions, and I was, again, like 11 or 12, and a lot of my narrative growing up was, you know, wanting to be liked and wanting to be one of the popular kids and not understanding why I wasn't. And I saw the high school girls, and they thought it was really cool to do that sort of European thing of, like, kissing each other on the cheek when they met each other.
Yes.
And so I was mimicking them, and one of my friends came to the show, and I did that. I kissed her on both cheeks. It wasn't sexually loaded at all. Like, I didn't have really any inkling of that, but there was this little shit of a girl in my class who just, she spread the rumor that I was gay throughout the middle school, and I didn't even know really what that was. I hadn't seen that. I certainly hadn't met a gay person up to that point in my life.
And to clarify, you're in what state of the union?
Oh, Wisconsin.
Yes, not necessarily the progressive hub.
And I just knew that it was, I didn't want to be bullied, and I didn't want people shoving me into lockers or throwing basketballs or pieces of produce at my head anymore, because that's what was happening. And so I'm like, oh, so, okay, gay means liking girls, so I should like boys, and I should be really performative about that. I think looking back, I didn't consciously have that thought pattern, but looking back on my behavior, I think that's how I'm like, oh, this is the role I should play. And that was sort of, yeah, that was sort of how I dealt with a lot of that bullying, was being really demonstrably attracted to guys. Which is, I mean, it's not to say that wasn't honest and I wasn't attracted to those guys, but I think I amplified it, you know, in a performative sense. And I don't know. It was interesting because my best friend from growing up, Julia, ended up being gay, and I remembered her saying that she had a crush on someone in high school, and she wouldn't tell me who it was, and she wouldn't tell me who it was, and then she told me, and it was a girl, and I was like, okay, but like not really comprehending it, you know, because again, it was foreign to me, and then going to college and Luther had a great, you know, GLBTQ alliance, and I met, you know, some of my best friends, again, in college were gay, but I never felt like I had a safe place to talk about my sexuality or gender expression, and it wasn't really until I came out to Whidbey Island And again, like, it's not only finding those pockets of theater families, but again, I think it's like GLBTQ theater families, like, have been what I've been subconsciously drawn to. And so it was interesting. It was, so like last year I was like, hey, not that I've been like living a lie my whole life, but sort of recognizing that I had really tampered down the side of my sexuality that was attracted to women, and coming to terms with not coming to terms with that. That sounds really depressing, but like celebrating both sides of that. And instead of being like, no, I can only like boys. And I think it's hard, again, growing up in the Midwest, that's the narrative that parents want, is that sort of thing. Like, I want it to be easy for my child.
Right.
And so I want, you know, I want her to get married to a nice man who's going to take care of her. And they're going to have 2.5 kids. And
yeah, it's not a prejudice of malice.
Yeah.
It's not, it's just that there is that side of it that in some ways it's easier, in quotes,
right,
to be cisnormative in our society.
Absolutely.
However, of course, it's not worth not being you.
Yeah.
And I think you ended up in the right place.
Thank you. Yeah. It definitely, Whidbey Island definitely feels like home. And I mean, all of my theater friends in Seattle too. I love them. I love them as well. It's a really great family. Yeah. So like, yeah, I posted my like Facebook, I don't know if it was really, I had come out as bi or queer to friends individually or friends because of behaviors I had demonstrated, like making out with women at parties, had sort of been like, oh, light bulb. But I sort of had this post during, you know, for the second annual Queer Pride Parade on Whidbey Island, because I've been really inspired by women like Anna Paquin or Ellen Page coming out, not with a lot of fanfare, but doing it in a way that they knew the value that if it would help someone else who is feeling alone or feeling unsure about their identity, they could have maybe a role model or someone, or recognize they weren't that alone in the world. And so,
yeah.
So yeah, ta-da!
You actually just summed it up. I had that post up on my phone. Just a reference in case I needed it.
It was scary to do it, and I think there's a lot of, I mean, to my fate, I mean, and what was really cool was that little shit of a girl, I mean, we were all 11 or 12, right, who spread that rumor, like, she liked that Facebook post, and she was really supportive, you know, and so, yeah. Like, it comes around full circle, and it was interesting because it was like, I don't know, like almost 200 people liked that post, which was just an incredible outpouring of support. But being sort of the social media geek I am, I sort of noticed some people who I thought would have liked it who didn't like it. And I don't know, it's hard when you've performed your gender identity or sexual identity one way for so long, and then you're a person, you're evolving, and so it shifts. And I think there's some people, unfortunately, who are really rigid and like, this is how I know her, and this is, I think she's wrong, or I think she's going through a phase. And you sort of have to shake that off, and, yeah. You know, you do you.
Yeah, there was a cool article you shared, and the title was, Sexuality is Fluid, It's Time to Get Past the Idea of Born This Way.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of points, you know, we could talk for 5 hours
about
human sexuality and gender, queer fluidity, and mm-hmm. all of those things. But I think that you're touching on what society is coming to, which is that we don't need to be like, okay, this is how this person is.
Yeah, I absolutely. And even I feel sort of ambivalent about Kristen Stewart. I mean, I haven't seen any of the Twilight movies, but she just came out with this really great interview where there's a quote that was something like, I think 20 years from now, we're not going to have gay or straight anymore. It's just going to be people loving who they love. And it's going to be, these labels are going to be irrelevant. I'm paraphrasing, but I hope that that's what we're moving towards.
Me too.
Yeah.
And
I feel like this is like a very special podcast, an after school special with Michael Morgan and Katie Woodsick.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, it's important.
It is important to talk about these things because when I was a kid and growing up and going through puberty and all of that, I didn't have anything or I didn't have access to anything that would have helped me, you know, growing up in a suburb of Madison. And so I'm glad that the internet provides all these resources. And so kids who are questioning or not sure, and they don't have to be sure, but they have this support from people who they might never meet. And I think that's, you know, that's important.
Yeah. To me, that ties into theater a lot. Because when you're doing a theatrical production, you only need to touch one audience member, and it was worth doing the show.
Right.
It was worth it. Even if everyone else was like, oh, I don't like it. If you got that one person, and it changed something about the way they think or the way they see themselves, you did it. And I think this podcast accomplishes that. And things like the Queer Pride Parade that we just had here in Langley.
Yeah.
Which you were in, and Hedgebrook, and everybody.
Everybody
cool. Everybody. There. And I'll just say, like, this podcast isn't about me, but I'll just say, even from my perspective as basically a cisgender straight white male.
In his mid-white 30s.
You know, I'm not by choice top of the every food chain societally.
Right. Yeah.
But it even... The discussion of these things allows me to shed constraints of gender and sexuality too. And I think that's important for people to remember too, that even the people who are super conformative, performative, gender normative in our lives are also acting out something they've been taught.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, well, I was raised to grow up and be like, haha, nice boobs. You know? That's, hey, nice boobs. And that doesn't...
Thank you?
You do have nice boobs, but I just mean in general.
Yes.
That it's freeing to everybody to have those conversations. Even people who don't identify as gay, lesbian, queer, any of the spectrum. It really is freeing. So I think that's important. Moving right along.
Okay.
I recently saw an amazing play. It was called The Pillow Man.
Ah, yes.
At Outcast Productions.
I directed that play.
You did direct that play. That's why I brought it up. And I thought that was really awesome. You know, I will say I like to go see plays that my friends are in or have directed because I like to be supportive. And it's always really a nice bonus when it's good.
Because we've all been there when it's not been good.
We all have been.
This is my theater I'm going to just take a little moment to be my theater etiquette sort of thing, is I think that as I grow up, I learned to experience shows on two levels, and one is the subjective, what I really think about it artistically, and then there's the other level of, oh my God, they did live theater, this whole cast and crew has volunteered collectively hundreds of hours of their life to make this happen. And just that in alone of itself deserves a congratulations. No matter what you thought of it, you can always say congratulations.
Absolutely. And that's a good one. Congratulations. Great work. All of those things can be very true.
Yes. Theater going hacks.
Yes. I'm so glad I came. Things like that. But
that's what she said.
We'll get to that later.
Okay.
But tell me about your arc as a director. You started in college directing, is that right?
I did. In high school, I did a play we had forensics was like the speech. It wasn't speech and debate, but it was sort of the competitive, like you could do a monologue or a story or a group play or improv. And I gold medaled all 4 years at state, I'll have you know. My freshman year, we did a play called Impromptu, and it was a short play, I think maybe 20 minutes long, and I was in it with Kathleen Kylo and Alex Zupan and Jerome Fox, and so we got to do this play together, and so that was the first play I directed. We had a student-run theater at my college called Spin Theater, where you could just propose anything, and you had, after they paid for the rights, you had a budget about $200 to do whatever you wanted. And so I did that my junior year, I directed that. And later that same school year, I did an internship at the Commonweal Theater in Lanesboro, Minnesota, semester in residence. And during that, I also took an independent study acting class. And I have this habit, I don't want to say biting off more than I can chew, but if I'm going to direct, I want it to be something I'm really excited about. I don't like playing it safe. And so the scene I chose was part of the opening scene of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And so there I am. I'm 20 years old. I have two professional actors, Scott Dixon and Christine Winkler, and I'm directing them. And they were such good sports. And it was great. And, you know, we showed it at something like noon on a Thursday, and like three company members came.
Prime time.
Right? But then my senior year for my senior project, because when you're a theater major, you can do a project instead of a paper. I directed Beyond Therapy, which is a Christopher Durang piece that I love to death. It'd be fun to bring it out to Whidbey. It'd be fun to do it here. I think people would really like it. But the name of the project was Beyond Therapy, Beyond Social Constructions of Gender and Sexuality.
Nice.
And so I had all of my actors read a lot of gender performance theory, and it was so much fun. And we did three shows of it, and I remember I have this thing sometimes when I listen to songs and I can't stop listening to them. And so I was visiting my friend Emily in Iowa City, somewhere else in Iowa. And I was listening to one of the Weird Al Polka remixes where nice. He goes through a bunch of different pop songs.
Yeah.
And I'm just a big Weird Al fan. And so I kept listening to it and kept listening to it. And then I incorporated two of those as sort of the dumb shows before each act of the play. And so the actors, Jenny Shortridge, now Jenny Becker, choreographed these elaborate dance numbers that had all of the cast members in them. And it was just a blast. And we did it in Story Theater. And the first night, we're at like 75% capacity. The second night, we're pretty full. And then the last night, there were so many people that we had to pull suitcases from props for them to sit on. And I've never been in a room where people have laughed that hard before. That's and awesome. It was just, I mean, I had such a great cast. It was Blake Nellis and Ashley Hirschbeck and Xander Genre and Gary Dansu, Karen, who is used to be Downs, and now she has a married name, Karen Christian, and I'm forgetting some. Oh, Justin Wayne Ziegler. I love Justin Wayne Ziegler so much. And so it was amazing. And then I moved out here. I directed Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at Wicca. And then that was the last full-length play that I directed while I've been out here. I've done some smaller pieces and readings, but then Pillow Man was really the first full-length play I directed in about 5 or 6 years.
I was involved in one of your very small things, which was we did a double feature Reader's Theater.
Oh, yes!
Where David Meyer directed
Glass Menagerie
in its condensed form,
mm-hmm.
and you directed Christopher Durang's For Whom the Southern Bell Tolls,
yeah.
which is a spoof
mm-hmm.
of Glass Menagerie. Any yes. of you theater people out there, look up that script. It
you
is freaking hilarious.
It's amazing. Yes.
Max Koltak and Ecos with his collection of glass straws.
Swizzle sticks.
Is burned in my mind. So I just had to throw that in.
That was a fun early experience
I had with you. Do you have anything on the horizon as far as directing? Do you have anything on your list?
I do. Well, again, it's another thing where I am directing something next year, but it's not public Ooh. Yet. It's another Ooh. Thing. I feel so very Hollywood.
Top secret.
So there's definitely, yes, I'm going to be, I'm
we
glad.
We could do that fun thing where you say it and then we beep it out.
Say
and
it.
Thing.
It's going to be, I'm very excited. And it's interesting for me because it hasn't been until I worked at Hedgebrook, I wasn't really aware of the disparity of gender parity in theater. And so for me, it was like The Pillow Man was kind of my last hurrah of like directing a play by a white man.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I felt a little bit guilty doing it. I felt better because Outcast season this year did achieve gender parity. And so I sort of breathed a sigh of relief. But there's we were in an audition process last night where you just see there's so many women who want, you know,
yes.
There's so many women who come in for roles, and I'm not going to talk about the play. I'm not going to say the play that we were auditioning for, but there were, I mean, there half, no, a third, there's a three female leads and then seven male leads in this show. And I would say the ratio of female actors called back to male actors was the opposite of that. And so I
probably, yeah.
And so it's my mission going forward to probably pretty much only direct plays written by women. And I'm starting to get into playwriting a little bit myself. And there's just so many, you sometimes you do have to look a little bit harder, but organizations like the Kilroys have this great list where this is the second year that they've done it. They've gone to theater professionals around the country and asked for a list of their top plays written by women or trans writers that have only had one or fewer productions, full productions.
Yeah.
And so that's a great place to start if you're looking for plays written by women. Another great place is the New Play Exchange, where you can download scripts and all of that. But it's important. And I'm learning that's sort of my learning curve as a director, where you just really have to, it is important. You can't gloss over it. You can't sweep it under the rug. You can't say, oh, I'll do gender parity in my season when it's convenient. And so you have to sort of view, I'm trying to be, you know, an advocate for that in my work as a director.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about the state of gender in the arts, which is kind of sad and ironic because it's really at the forefront of liberal society in a lot of ways, and inclusive, accepting, equality minded people. And yet, I saw an article, I think maybe even you posted it. Katie posts all the coolest things.
I post everything.
About the woman who submitted all her pieces.
Catherine Nichols.
Yeah, yep. So she sent in a submission to publishers, and she sent it under the name George in one instance, and got 17 yeses out of 50.
I want to see your manuscript.
Yeah. Or yeah, wanting more positive responses. And when she sent it under her name, she got 2.
Yep.
And that's not like wiggle room difference. That's a big difference. And I'll say just a little bit, like from my perspective.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and I've even challenged you a little bit on this in times, because you work at Hedgebrook.
Yeah.
Hedgebrook is an amazing organization that is a women's writing retreat, and they also do other fabulous things. But a lot of the stuff they do there, I am not eligible to participate in, being a guy. And there's a part of me that has bristled at that because, like, I want to come.
I want to play.
I want to play. I too am a thinking individual, and I want to come be expressive. And I will admit that I've evolved on that in the sense that there's the concern of the individual and there's the concern of the society. And in any individual room, it doesn't matter if you pick a guy's play or a girl's play or a black person or a white person or a trans person or any of those things. If you're just going to do one, you pick someone in the room, it's not important who it is necessarily. But as a society, when you look at the truth of what we're seeing and what we're presenting, it's still overwhelmingly white males telling stories from their perspective, even if it's about women or about black people or about gay people.
Yeah.
It's still so often written, directed, produced, distributed by white males. And there's nothing wrong with white males. I can say, as one of them, we are not inherently flawed, but we only have one perspective. And so limiting society's perspective is not a thing. I'm just speaking as a convert. Now I'm rambling on your podcast.
No, I think it's great, and it's something I've really appreciated having this platform of the podcast, and recently having interviews with both Kathy Shea and Arlene Martinez Vasquez, who are both artists of color who are really trying to produce diverse works, and talking about how, and also Jeannie Cicada, who wrote Hold These Truths, and talking about how shifting the narrative so that the white male experience is not the universal experience, so that, you know, Japanese American can be a universal experience. You can have a character who's African American and queer, and that can be the, you know, universal experience. And so just having this podcast has opened my eyes even more to that, and I've been very grateful to the guests who've been in conversation with me about that. And then I'm also really glad around these parts for people like Shane Regan, who works at TPS, and he works extra hard to post the numbers in terms of what are theaters in Seattle producing. And he just, the Gregory Awards nominations are being announced this week. And last month, when all the numbers were in, he posted on Facebook and talked about how, even though in, because I think people are like, oh, we're progressive, we're in Seattle, like, it's not a problem, we're better than average, right? Not so much. Matcha Monkey Productions had 100% works written or co-written by women. Copious Love, I think, was at 80%, but, and then I think Annex Theater was at 40 to 50, and maybe there was another one at that level, but everyone else was at 22% or below, which is the national average. And so, and Courtney Meeker, who's a playwright who I absolutely adore, she's been on the podcast a couple times, and she's talked about how that's a great first step to just crunch the numbers, because it's really hard for people to get upset with numbers. If I go to you and say, hey, your season sucks, you're not producing enough women, of course, you know,
I might get defensive.
Right. But if you calmly share the numbers and say, hey, these are your numbers for the past couple seasons, as someone who likes to go see theater and likes to spend money on a ticket, I want to let you know that I would like your numbers to be more equitable.
Yeah.
And that's powerful. That's powerful.
It is powerful, and it's socially important, and, you know, newsflash, it's good for business.
It's true.
Because for some reason, people are stuck in this idea of producing all these things that are on some level or another traditional.
Right.
In their perspectives.
Let's do Neil Simon again.
Neil Simon, you know, and that's it's not Neil Simon's fault.
Right.
That he's overproduced.
Yes, and I'm not saying that.
No, I know you're not. And that's the thing, too, where people are like, well, there's nothing wrong with Neil Simon.
It's great. It's like, great, start off with the Neil Simon piece, but then have a Sarah O'Rourke piece afterwards, or Kiara Alegría-Hudgens, or Lyd Nottage. You know what I mean? Like, there are other options. You don't have to... And also, knowing that your audience will trust you, you know? Your audience will come and see what you think is important for them to see.
Exactly. And that's something I think local theaters here on Whidbey Island are embracing in a lot of ways. You know, Outcast Theater Group did a Sarah Rule show that we were in together.
Mm-hmm.
The Vibrator
play. There were vibrators in that play.
Yes, there were. I touched them all. And and Wicca is doing a Sarah Rule show this year, Dead Man's Cell Phone.
They're on track this year to have of the four main stage shows that they've announced, 50-50, gender parity. And I hope that moving forward with planning the one-act festival, that they're able to continue that awesome trend.
Yeah, it's refreshing and eye-opening, and it expands everyone's horizons. It was really cool for me to be a male, one of the lead characters in a play written by a woman about things having to do with women in the Vibrator play, because the wife of my character is really the lead,
right?
Character-wise, and I caught myself in a male privilege moment when I hadn't really read the script yet, thinking my character was the main character. I totally thought that it's about the guy who invented the vibrator. Yeah, that's me. I'm the main guy. I'm not the main guy in that show. No, I mean, I'm it's an important part, but she's the main part character, and that journey that she goes through as a woman right. in that scenario is the main thing. So it's good for everybody. So, Katie Woodzik.
Michael Morgan.
How did you get so awesome?
I'm laughing because that's a question that I threw out to you to ask me, and I think I meant it more as a joke.
That's why I asked it, to catch you off guard.
That's amazing. I have to give a lot of props to my parents because my mother was just right there. Anytime I had an emerging interest, she got me oboe lessons, she got me acting lessons, she got me singing lessons. And so I feel like I was really privileged that way to have someone who went and found those opportunities for me to perform a lot growing up. And actually, I remember being in parent-teacher conferences when she would ask my English teachers what the ratio was of female-to-male authors that they were teaching me.
Nice.
And, like, being a kid and being really annoyed because the teacher got uncomfortable and being like, let's go back to talking about how great I am, guys. And then my dad he's such an awesome guy, and he's very much an academic, and we would read, like, Sherlock Holmes growing up and instead of Dr. Seuss, and they're both super supportive in coming to, you know, all of my productions in high school and college. And I think that starting out was very, very, very important to have that foundation of support from my family. My best friend growing up, Julia Hanaway, I just lucked out that we moved in next door to her because we would memorize all the songs to Disney movies and perform them in the backyard. We would record ourselves at a talk girl, and we would record ourselves doing these long, intricate improvisations. And yeah, I was surrounded by really awesome, encouraging people growing up. I think that was really, really helpful.
When you're wicked famous, those talk girl tapes are like someone's gonna find them. Like Katie Woodzik's talk girl for sale on eBay, right. $92,000.
I think, and teachers growing up, I remember I basically started school in second grade. I don't know if I've told you this story.
I don't think you have.
Because I have an August birthday. This is why this is happening in August. And it's that weird thing where they don't quite know where to put you in grade school, like which grade you should be in. My mother rightfully held me back, didn't put me in the school system for a year because the school that I was supposed to go to, they were ripping asbestos out. And she was like, no, my daughter's not going there. And that was the year I would have gone to kindergarten. And so I had just turned 7 years old, and they started off by putting me in first grade. And then they gave me a bunch of reading tests, and after 2 weeks, they skipped me up to second grade. And I was in Elsie Wilson's class, and she was, she had been a teacher for years, and she was really amazing and, again, encouraging. And I remember I had this, you know, this spirit of wanting to do things and making things happen, because I was obsessed with the show Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Oh, yeah.
And so I pitched it to her that we needed to do that in the class. Like, we needed to play Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego for geography lessons. And she went with it. Like, she went with it. And so once a month, we would do, like, our version of Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
And I was in a box, and that was my office. I was the chief, and I had a walkie-talkie, and Carrie Creron was the host, and I would call him into my office just like the chief would on the PBS show.
That's awesome.
And so even from that age, I was lucky to be encouraged to sort of do my own thing. And so, yeah, teachers are awesome. who encourage you to do, and just having a lot of teachers or people along the way, like I said, that accompanist who told my mom, get her singing lessons, or I remember Jerome Fox's mother, Susan Fox, I had her for social studies in eighth grade saying, she should go to a small liberal arts college. That's where she should go. And so having really awesome people looking out for me and supporting me, I think that's why I'm so awesome, Michael Morgan.
You are so awesome. We could edit this out if you want to, but I can't tell how long we've been talking.
Oh.
How do I see?
It's for 168 bars. Which is not helpful at all.
I don't remember when we started, so I think
we've been going for like, I don't know, 50 minutes.
Okay, so we're getting towards the end.
Edit this out because I'm gonna put it up this weekend. I don't wanna spend time editing it.
That's fine. So, you get the behind the scenes thing. Yeah. GarageBand, it counts in measures.
Well, this is what I was talking. I usually record it on another. So this is like the upgraded GarageBand, which usually it has the timing at the bottom in the old version, and so that's why I didn't want to update it. That's why we had trouble starting to record it earlier.
Gotcha. All right. So let me ask you a couple last ending questions.
Okay.
What's your biggest challenge right now? What's the hard thing that you feel like it's getting in your way and it's the thing that is like needs to be overcome?
That's a great question. I think the older I get, the more I realize that we really have to define success for ourselves. And so that's something I'm coming to terms with. I was really okay with and excited to turn 30 until like the middle of last week when I realized it was coming up. And then, you know, all that sort of crippling self-doubt of, I'm a failure, I haven't accomplished enough, I'm going to be a lonely old cat lady, oh my God. That all sort of creeps in full force. But I think I've recently read Aziz Ansari's book, Modern Romance, and it was really helpful because it talks about how with the advent of online dating, that we have more choices than ever before, and that can be frustrating. But then also, we have a higher likelihood of finding someone we're really, really passionate about.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful. I think that's a weird way of roundabout answering that I'm sort of a workaholic in terms of I'm still trying to find being comfortable in those quiet places and not getting wrapped up in the tornado of busy, busy, busy. Being like, okay, I can be alone with just myself, and that's okay.
That's big.
It's big. It's been, I would say, like, that's, and I've come, so, like everyone else, I'm a work in progress, but being okay with being alone in all the senses of that word,
yes,
is a big challenge for me that I'm still working on. And then also, defining what success means for me personally, and not trying to compare myself against or with other people would be the challenges, Michael Morgan.
Okay. On the flip side,
mm-hmm,
what's your pot of gold right now? What's
my
that
pot
thing?
Pot of gold?
So like you have projects coming up. You've,
yes,
got roles. You've got, mm-hmm, things you might be directing. You've got this podcast, which is awesome. What's the thing out beyond all that that you're almost uncomfortable to tell us that you're shooting for?
That's also a really good question. I would say, sort of as a caveat or response to the last question, I see people in my life who are making it as an artist and just as an artist in whatever way that means to them. And I still feel like I'm compartmentalizing, like I have this great job serving an arts organization and then I do my art at night. And so I would like to find a way to integrate making art into more of my life. And I don't quite know what that would look like, what that pot of gold would be exactly, but I think I'll know it when I see it, when I feel it, when I am adjacent to it, when it's on the horizon. Because I feel like, I don't know, I feel like I'm not brave enough to do that. If that makes any sense. Pshaw. Or I don't quite understand the mechanics behind people who are able to make art pay. And so I would like to move towards that in the future.
Well, I think that will happen.
Oh, I hope so. That would be great.
There we go. And I think just in the time I've known you, the amount of visible, tangible, intangible growth and expansion and blooming and like grabbing that thing and tackling it and being awesome that you've done is something you need to remind yourself of.
Yeah.
Because, and that's hard. All you listeners too, remind yourself of the things you've accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely. It's
because really since I met you, when it was like, oh, wow, she's a pretty good singer. She's cool in this show. Like, we didn't know what the Katie Woodzik was. I didn't mean she's a pretty good singer.
We didn't know the nature of the beast.
She's actually, like, annoyingly fantastic. It's like, it's not. But, and now you've got this podcast. You are ruling at Hedgebrook. You are social media-ing. You're directing, you're acting, you're singing. You're doing all these things that you love. And for me, it's just a short matter of time till you get that thing that you're looking for. So, happy birthday, Katie Woodzik.
Thank you, Michael Morgan. Thank you for having the idea to interview me on my own podcast. I love it.
It's been a genuine pleasure. And we'll just do a little plug here at the end. When people hear this podcast and are so moved and blown away that they feel they want to support it somehow, how could they do that?
Thank you.
How could they do it?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So if you go to theatricalmustang.podbean.com, that's the website for the show. There's a little donate button where you can toss a few bucks my way, which would be great because right now it's all a labor of love. We have some in-kind sponsorships from people, but it would be great to get some gas money, some ferry money, some parking money. I'm always glad to donate my time to do the editing and stuff, but it would be nice to get some support.
Yeah,
just, you know, like five bucks here and there from people. I mean, if you have like $1,000.
Also acceptable.
That'd be amazing. Also I would take acceptable. That money too.
And it's an investment, really, because then, you know, a few years down the road, then when Katie Woodzik is burning on fire in the stratosphere of all things, and you'd be like, oh yeah, I helped. That's right. Call in a favor later. If you're that guy that's sending $1,000, you're like, hey, can I come visit you at the Oscars? And so that concludes our happy birthday amazingness.
Aww.
Katie Woodzik podcast. Keep on listening, awesome people. I have been Michael Morgan. This is still Katie Woodzik. Good luck and good night.
Thanks, everyone.